Good morning, everyone. First of all, I have to thank you all for getting here so early in the morning. We are very appreciative. This is the Grantmakers in Film and Electronic Media membership briefing. GFEM is an affinity group of the Council on Foundations, and our mission is to help funders support media, media arts, as well as public interest media. This session today is interesting in its scheduling. We are going to convene here for a little while. Then we're all together going to go across the hall and hear the Morphing the Media session. And then we'll turn around and come back in here and hear the last part of our briefing. I have to absolutely encourage you to come back, because we have a terrific set of panelists for the morning. And I'm not going to talk very long because I want to get started so that we have enough time for your questions. Our one piece of housekeeping, you'll see that there's a clipboard with a sign-in sheet, and if during the course of the morning, if you would, you know, fill out your name and affiliation and email address and pass it on. So, our first portion of our membership briefing is a conversation between Jeff Chester and Lynn Stern. Jeff Chester is an author. He is one of the most important people in our country that hold the media's feet to the fire. As we all have felt over the last several years, that we have had a very difficult time in getting information, getting truthful information, and the infrastructure of the media has changed tremendously. Jeff has written about it, he blogs about it, he reports on it, he sends people in the direction of where the truth and information might be. And his current book, Digital Destiny, has just come out, and we highly recommend it to you all. He is going to be talking with our Media Policy Working Group program coordinator, Lynn Stern. Lynn is also a program officer at the Cerdna Foundation, and we thought rather than have a straight presentation, that we would have a conversation. So I give you Jeff Chester and Lynn Stern. Thank you.
Thanks, Alice. Can everyone hear me? Great. Thank you all for coming very early this morning, but I know that you're not going to regret it. We have with us a wonderful, passionate speaker, Jeff Chester, and I can guarantee you that this is going to be a provocative, highly caffeinated conversation with Jeff. So let me just, before we begin, tell you a little bit about the Media Policy Working Group at GFEM. We are a very loose cohort of funders in a variety of fields and disciplines, anything from arts to economic development, community development, and human rights. And we formed about 2003 at a point where we were all faced with the burgeoning, interest and demand for better knowledge around media policy, and recognizing the effects that media policy was having on all of our fields, specifically in terms of getting messages out that we wanted our publics to hear about the work that we do and the issues that we care about. So we formed this small group. I shouldn't say small, actually. We've grown quite a bit. We're about 45 members, some of whom are very active, some of whom engage with us primarily on an informational basis. We really focus on building knowledge and sharing our learning around media policy, and we do this through a number of ways, one of which is through our quarterly phone briefings on, you know, timely issues related to media policy coming up, and there is always something going on in media policy. And secondly, we also work on a quarterly email, or I should say e-newsletter, that comes out on a quarterly basis that focuses on media policy issues and informational pieces that are of use to our membership. And finally, we do quite a few in-person convenings, networking events to bring people together to again, share our learning and to, you know, really build a community around media policy issues. So I encourage you, if you have any interest in joining us, please let us know. You can indicate that on the sign-in sheet, or, you know, feel free to hand me your card or to Kelly in the back, and we'd be happy to put you on our email list. So today, as Alice noted, we have a tremendous speaker with us. Jeff Chester has been called by Bill Moyers the Paul Revere of the media revolution. He is a media policy visionary, a prolific writer on the conventional waves, and blogger, and an articulate voice around the digital revolution that we are now facing. And he's here to talk about a range of issues, but primarily I wanted us to focus a bit on some of the things that he brings up in his book, Digital Destiny. And if you haven't gotten it yet, I encourage you to do so. There's a wonderful, a delightful read of the history from the past 10 years, from the beginnings of the Telecommunications Act of 1996, and everything that has happened since brings us up to the present day. It's very informative. And Jeff has also, in the final chapter, given us his policy agenda for the broadband era. So it's a great read, and I hope you'll pick it up at your community bookstore.
Al's bookstore.
But today what I'd like to do is really focus on Chapter 7. This is an intriguing chapter for me as somebody who's been working in the media policy arena for a few years now, which has been primarily focused on issues of media consolidation and things related to the rewrite of the Telecommunications Act that is coming up. And but what Jeff is pointing out here is another phenomenon that is really happening, at least in my experience, kind of under the radar screen. And I'd like to focus on those ideas that he articulates in the chapter of policy. The chapter which is called Marketing and Micro-Persuasion in the Digital Era. And specifically, you know, we've all pretty much, actually a lot of us has been brought to media policy because of our passion around the potential of the internet and now the potential of other new media to democratize and to communicate and to bring us in communities in ways that we've never experienced before. And that's, you know, really drives a lot of our fight around media policy to keep the internet open and to fulfill its potential as a civic engagement opportunity. But what Jeff is pointing out here is something somewhat insidious and quite frightening. And it's really the power of the commercial sector, and specifically the communications, the marketing, advertising, and high-tech industries that are looking at how they can mine the commercial aspects of the internet and new media, how they can monetize that. And what Jeff starts to shape, bring together in that chapter and has since written extensively about is a really frightening picture for all of us. So, and one, in fact, that I guess in one of the studies that you can actually grab in the front table there, the word communitainment has actually been coined to describe this potential from the perspective of the commercial sector. So I think I'd like to just use that as a springboard to start off our conversation. And if I might just start that, you know, have Jeff give us some flesh to that scary specter.
Thanks, Lynn, and thanks, Alice, and thank you all. Thank you for the digital sunrise semester. You probably heard this before. We're in a critical transition period. It's, you know, from the so-called old media to new media. If you have young kids, if you know young kids, if you have, you know, kids and teenagers, not just here, but in Brazil or in middle class in China or anywhere, you know that a whole new approach to media has emerged. All right? That we know that this new media system has incredible power. All right? and that kids, in fact, have a whole different relationship with media. I suggest to you that anything positive that we want to see in terms of civil society or social justice has to be consciously and deliberately placed inside this system during this transition, because the people who are most organized, the people who are most focused, the people who have already made all that investment are the media companies and the advertisers and the technology companies. They have created a system, and that will unleash, and I don't think there's that much we can do about it in some way, but we have to address it, that will unleash an incredible consumerist culture, because it's all about being able to follow us wherever we are, whether we are online or on your mobile phone. And I think I sent you, Lynn, I'm happy to share with you some of the online videos. There's nothing like hearing it from the industry themselves about what they're doing. It's all about promoting consumption, brand awareness, product acquisition. That's the most powerful organized force. The force is to promote social justice, civil society, economic opportunity, diversity of ownership, a serious news system. At this moment of crisis, when I like to say we have a warning sign, the press's failure with Iraq, the press's failure to cover the Gulf, these are warning signs like natural disasters, like global warming. We have to take this seriously. Otherwise, we will end up with a system where young people, I fear, will be more focused on serving their own needs and not the needs of all of us to work together to fix the problems at hand.
Well, let me just see if you can help us better understand on a more concrete level what's going on here. I mean, you know, a lot of us have children here who are of ages where they are, you know, basically living their lives on these social networks, on the internet and through cell phones. Tell me, what are they tracking? How are they tracking it? How is this affecting privacy issues that we're not even thinking about yet?
Well, look, and it's one of the reasons why I wrote my book, and I looked at adults, and I'm going to plug my wife's book, Catherine Montgomery, who's a professor at American University. Her book comes out June 1st, and it's called Generation Digital. And she looked at kids, and both of us have come together, and with the support of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and the California Endowment, we will be releasing a report in 2 weeks, just to sort of say, that really underscores how this system is already put in place targeting kids and teens and how it is negatively affecting their physical health. So, and I say that just to respond that the system is already out there in very, very powerful ways. And that's one reason. And interactive advertising is, in fact, the business model for most of the content being created now. And it's all based on this unlimited ability. Look, they can track, and they track wherever you're, when you go on a website, commercial website.
For instance, if my child is on MySpace.
Well, we're talking about my daughter. Well, MySpace is very interesting. And I can also share with you, which is going to be in our report, the media kit. For MySpace. I mean, the entertainment communications industry understands where things are going on a global basis. That's why they're buying this stuff. That's why Murdoch bought MySpace, right? That's why Viacom bought Xfire, this very popular video game site. That's why Google bought YouTube, and now the most powerful interactive advertising company 2 weeks ago, DoubleClick, in order to both have the ability to bring people's eyeballs to the PC, the mobile device, which is going to be very, very important in the United States, and ultimately interactive television, and then being able to track wherever they go and able to reach them wherever they are, whenever you are online. See, there's a flaw in the U.S. privacy law, and which is that, and we've been sold a kind of fallacious assumption, which some of us are trying to address, and we will be addressing this, Catherine and I, when we release this report in terms of kids, because we got the only privacy law through Congress in the 90s, the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act. The reason they can't target as well kids 13 and under is because of the law that we got passed. But regardless of whether or not they don't have your name or your email address, every one of us is given a file, a number, when we visit a website. All right. And what's happened, that file now, over the last 3 or 4 years, has been incredible technological breakthroughs. I covered in the book, and last November, we wrote a complaint to the Federal Trade Commission with USPIRG, where we really laid out what's going on, because developments have moved so quickly, it's frightening. Not only are they able to track your individual behaviors on a specific website, so for example, when your kid is going on, any of the Nickelodeon sites, or what we talked about, Neopets, you know, or any site, they're able to track exactly where your mouse is on the page, what content you like, what content you don't like, what you do with the shopping cart. That's called all your online behaviors. It's called behavioral targeting. They're tracking that at individual sites. And over the last 2 years, they've developed a whole new approach called retargeting, where all these websites, including the New York Times and the Washington Post and some of the biggest publishers, are all working together to share that information about you across the internet, which is why you may see an ad for a travel product on a different site, even though you were looking for this travel product when you were on Orbitz. So it's a tremendous, sophisticated data collection system. They have designed, this is why I'm saying we have to worry, because they've designed these technologies to be purposely, quote, unquote, immersive. They understand that it's not just the internet. We're talking about, the new generation of the internet is virtual reality. You know, it's placing yourself within these sites. It's having these sites work on you on a multimedia basis. And the advertising industry is also engaged in a very serious research effort on brain research, which I talk about in my book, to, in their own words, deliberately bypass our conscious minds in order to get our emotions to engage with the brand.
This is really scary.
It is. Look, and I think that with the exception, frankly, of stuff like obesity for kids and prescription drugs for seniors and a few other groups we can say we shouldn't do this, this is going to be the default system. All right. This is really at the heart. It's what's under the hood of the media system, not just in the United States, but everywhere.
It reminds me of what the tobacco companies did, when they created Joe Camel, and essentially are creating this, very unconscious marketing mechanism to draw teens into, purchasing and becoming addicted to tobacco. But this is far more,
I think
insidious.
It's more insidious. And so I'm concerned not about us, but about the youth. We need to ensure that young people are connected to civil society, are connected to communities. We'll be working for social justice. We'll be working to address all these issues. But if the most powerful organized force in their lives is self-satisfaction, right, then I suggest, and entertainment. And that's where, and let me tell you, the internet is changing. I want to respond to communitarian. The internet is changing. If you look at the investment like we do, look at the investment. Last year, $72 billion in the United States in mergers and acquisitions in the new media sector, right? $2 to $3 billion spent investing on venture capital, and I gave you a handout. Huge market research and how Hispanics and Hispanic youth, for example, are really in the forefront of using interactive cell phone technology to target Latino Hispanic kids. Same with African American kids, which we'll be covering in our study in a few weeks. They have done this research. They know where the market is going, and they understand that the internet is changing. That as a result of this investment and as a result of the kids' interest in being part of these social networks, and I think this is the key, we should not cede the gathering place that's going to emerge, these social networks, just to private interests. All right, and Piper Jaffray, this major Wall Street investment company, came out with a report in February, and I gave you a copy of the findings, and it said in 10 years from now, half of all internet usage will be on quote-unquote communitainment sites, because they understand that for young people, it's community and communications and commerce and entertainment's the glue. If that, in fact, gets the eyeballs, if we cede the control over to the Murdochs and the Viacoms and all that, and there's a new wave of investment at the local level, right, for community networks, and I think we have an opportunity to empower local people, real people, to shape and control and financially benefit from these networks, then we will have a harder time achieving, I believe, most of what we need to do.
All right, so let's talk about, we've heard the clarion call now for action.
All right.
And but this seems like a huge problem, and we're up against an industry that has huge resources and already is light years ahead in terms of research. What can the public interest community do to help counteract this in some way?
I have a couple of ideas. Look, the next wave of investment, you know, if you follow the industry, which the new media industry, which I do, and like I say, you should go look at paidcontent.org every day, Monday through Friday. Paidcontent.org covers the daily investment from the venture capital sphere within new media. You should look at iMedia Connection, one word, letter I, .com, and ClickZ, C-L-I-C-K-Z.com. These are two of my favorite websites. If you really want to know the future of where the Internet is going, read those two online interactive content trade publications. Ad Ages is also useful. The next wave of investment is the local networks. They understand that there's an intrinsic need that kids are living their lives online. In fact, Yahoo research indicates that already young people psychologically simultaneously are living their lives both in this world and online, and that's how in part they're creating the content. If you know things like Second Life, or a virtual Laguna Beach that I mean, it sounds like an oxymoron.
What is
okay? Laguna Beach is a look. We have a lot of
scared to ask.
We have a lot of problems to address. Well, there's a whole new world we have to organize for social justice, and that's called the virtual world. And I mean, the technology is amazing. They've created these virtual 3D sites. Second Life is the most popular one. Coca-Cola. If you do a Google search for Coca-Cola Second Life, you'll see Coca-Cola launched a whole new brand promotion last week, and I sent Lynn the videos, and I happened to send to you. Look, they've created these online environments which are very, very attractive
So
Laguna Beach is a series on MTV that's very, very popular with teens. Uh-huh. They've created a virtual version. And this is what we have to fight, where they are encouraging the viewers to create their own representations called avatars and to be with the celebrity avatars in relationships in order, in fact, to create the kind of relationship with the brand, either the sponsors who get to have their own avatars in there. I'm not making this up, believe me, I wish I was, and the show. And that's on the plane here. I mean, said there's nothing like, you know, reading it from this is a good magazine. It's called OMMA. And Online Media Daily is a fabulous thing to read, by the way. Absolutely. Every day you will be horrified. But there's 20 publications. Look, I get all my material from the trades, like I tell people, you know. But they only have one print publication, which says it was quite interesting. They have about 20 or 30 online publications. But I was reading this article, Do Avatars Dream of Nike Sneakers? And here's what it says. The web itself will add value to our lives by becoming more like a shadow self, a parallel me. The next web will apply massive artificial intelligence to our past online behaviors, personal information, and what we're doing now. You know, then this professor from Ohio State says it will know what you are doing, where you need to go, who else will be there, and push information to you that you can use even before you know you need it. This major investment in this world. All right, so community networks, because I know we have time is short. The industry, the venture community understands that in addition to these national networks like Facebook and MySpace, that there's an opportunity to have community networks in San Francisco, in Dallas, in all these cities. And they recognize, and this is one of my messages to you, that right now the barriers to entry, the financial barriers to entry are low. Because we're dealing with a medium that works over the PC, right? That eventually will have to get onto the mobile phone and the TV. But right now, you can create an online network and attract young people for very little money. Why do we want, that's what I ask, why do we want to cede that investment, the ability to organize, you know, and the profits just to people interested in bringing home a bigger paycheck? Why don't we try to bring community people together and organizers together to create these social networks, right? To give young people what they want, community and communications and indeed entertainment, but also begin to explore what the sustainable business models are that these communities can engage in. Because I think they can do advertising. There's going to be huge amounts of money to be made. But think about it. Advertising that respects your privacy. Advertising that promotes sustainability. Advertising that puts revenues back into the community. There's all kinds of things that need to be explored. If we need to have an online media system where social justice and multimedia production are paid for.
Okay.
And I think there's an opportunity here with the Web 2.0 and community networks.
Okay, so just before we break for questions, just give us your one-sentence suggestion about where philanthropy, where can somebody in a foundation that has not a lot of resources can invest make a difference?
I think in every community, you should be looking at who is doing the social networks for my community, who's about to come in, who's in, and who are my grantees who might be interested. Who are the community groups, the neighborhood groups, the community media groups, people that created your public radio station or your alternative radio station or even your access channel, but community groups, and bring them together. And look, just brief them about what is happening in the market. The biggest problem, I think, with the media reform community, of which I've been a member for many, many years, is they're not focused on the market. And I suggest to you, my final thought is this, that events are moving so quickly that it's outstripped the ability of the policy community and I think even the reform community to address it. If you have a 5 or 10 year window where you want to build sustainability for social justice in, we have to do it now through investment and creation, I think, in the marketplace. While we also work on the policy stuff, but the policy stuff may end up, frankly, being on the margins because very powerful behaviors are now being purposely developed between these media sources and young people.
Okay. Well, I think Jeff Chester has wakened this audience and scared the bejesus out of us. So I'd like to throw open the floor to questions. He said a lot of, quite frankly, provocative ideas for philanthropy. Let's hear it.
Hello. Hi. David Haas, William Penn Foundation and GFAM. A lot of points to enter in here, but also with kids. You neglected a huge constituency, which I probably did too, which is where is the energy with young people on campuses? I mean, Facebook, it was a student who wanted to, you know, create a place for people to meet. Can you give examples or think about opportunities that might spring from, and I see my kids, again, they're networked with their friends all the time. They also play baseball, and they say, well, who's going skating Friday night? Can you talk a little bit about examples of where there might be opportunity as well, our community groups? And I'm not a young person, but on campus in my city, I am sure there are people who are very smart, who may be entrepreneurs, but also might have a social mission component. Maybe it's environment or so forth. Can you talk a little bit about potential opportunities there, or how to spot them?
No, I hope I'm responding, David, to what you said. Look, I think there's unlimited opportunities if we begin to organize. I mean, I think that there is this tremendous impulse. And there are these wonderful things going on all across the board with the internet, particularly with youth. And I think the fact that young people reached out in Facebook, and instant messaging at the tragedy that occurred in Virginia Tech just gives you a glimpse. And a lot of good things are happening. But I suggest to you that this is what I worry about, that the public interest community sort of thinks that if we just sort of stand back on its own, the new media will develop and support civil society. Radio didn't do that. Television didn't do that. Cable didn't do that, right? And it's been a rearguard action ever since. We are at this moment again. We have the same business model, but this unlimited potential with the technology. There are so many allies, but we have to build in these institutions, right? You know, and just finally, if in fact Piper Jaffray is right, and I think they are, that the corporate investment is shaping our new media future to give these kids the entertainment as in the foreground, right? And they're going to be doing all kinds of things. You know, if you hit the ad, you'll be getting free cell phone moments. They're already doing that now, right? That our ability to come back 10 years from now and say, oy, can we do it, will be more difficult. Yes, hold a town meeting. Bring people together. There is this unlimited opportunity to make a difference, I think, if we act now.
Other questions?
Okay, they're all too scared.
Do you want to find out when I see my therapist again? I stopped, but I maybe I should go back.
Is he online?
She? Yeah.
Jeff.
No, she's, as a matter of fact, she wasn't.
Ann Del Castillo from POV.
Yeah.
I read an article a few weeks ago, there was a couple of months ago in New York Magazine, that was really about what young people are doing online and how, you know, all of them are a majority of them are putting up these social networking sites where they're putting basically their lives on the sites. And basically it helped me understand, because I tend to be one of those people that doesn't put stuff online. But the basis of the article was basically that young people today understand that there is no privacy. They understand that your information is out there, and they're just exploiting that. And so I'm just wondering if it really is a question of trying to fight, you know, trying to preserve privacy, or just accepting the fact that there is no more privacy anymore.
Well, look, the other thing they're doing, by the way, which is going to make them, look, they call it nano-targeting now. See, the advertising industry and the major content makers, they're looking at the kids' tag content, kids' bookmark content. All that information is now being collected and being placed in your profile for targeting purposes. Look, I'm really one of the few people fighting the commercialism stuff and have been. I, though, think we have to be realistic. This is the dominant global system, all right? And we can try to do our best here, but I think that it's going to be an uphill fight. Look, Google just bought the biggest interactive Google is an advertising company. But it's an advertising company for search. It just bought the biggest interactive advertising company to deliver the advertising for the video that it just bought YouTube for. Okay, I mean, this is where the world is going. So I think that we have to fight for privacy, and we have to make sure that vulnerable groups get protected. I mean, wait 2 weeks from now when we release our report about kids, all right, and see the reaction, all right? And it'll tell you, if you can't get stuff for kids, then you can't get stuff for anything. So it'll be interesting, you know, to see what happens here with kids in health.
We got some other questions.
Anyway.
Yeah.
John Schwartz from CITF in Boulder. Jeff, you're positing, I think, a public sector online. Did I hear correctly this would be supported by ads?
Yes. Here's what I think. That
So how are you going to avoid being part of the evil machine?
Well, let me tell you what I think. Here's what I think we have to explore. Young people, and some of you may know, I've worked in public broadcasting for many, many years. More recently, I helped get rid of Ken Tomlinson as head of CPB. I did that because he threatened the role the public broadcasting could play with in news. At the same time, young people really have far fewer problems with commercialism than I do and we do. The entire culture they will be living in is going to be a transaction, all right? So I've come to the conclusion that that while we try to fight some of it, we should also figure out, are there ways of taking advantage of it? And if people are going, in fact, to buy their travel, to download their music, to get ringtones, you know, maybe to get credit cards, to do all that stuff, why shouldn't some of that money go to community people? All right? And why can't we try to come up with a socially responsible model for running the online world where we do respect your privacy, we don't promote the foods that create obesity, right? You know, we try to put money back in the community, and we're taking that money and we're investing so that people who are poor actually have jobs in what will be, as I say, beyond defense and healthcare, the biggest money maker this world has seen is new media. Why do we want the money just to go elsewhere? It doesn't make sense to me.
I think we got a question from Helen.
Hi, Helen Bruner, Coyote Foundation and Media Democracy Fund. Jeff, you and I have talked about this a lot, and I want to segue from John's question to some of the research Catherine has done and others that point to the fact that young people really don't distinguish between commercial and non-commercial content. So I think we need to really think bigger about how we're going to communicate social justice messages and overcome our own reticence around, you know, what kinds of firewalls we build around advertising. But a second point here is that I think we really need to move beyond, thank you, Jeff, for offering the opportunity of philanthropy, of having convenings about this and educating people about this, but I think we need to move more quickly. I think we need to have convenings, but we also need to start some very local, targeted projects as kind of you know, pilot projects, if you will. And I was talking to Four Freedoms Fund last night, in case any of you are interested in this, about starting social networking projects in gateway immigrant communities and looking to the mobile phone piece, which is really where we're going if you want to look a year down the line.
People will be making their decisions about who to vote for president based on what happens with their mobile phone, I predict to you, all right? And right now, we need to organize a public interest presence on those mobile phones.
Okay.
One more question.
Debbie Zimmerman, Women Make Movies. I actually just wanted to make a comment rather than a question and kind of echo what Anne was saying and also what you were saying, Jeff. I think, it starts so far before Facebook. My niece is 9 years old. She has a little penguin community where they all get this penguin and they house the penguin and they feed the penguin. And it's total consumerism. But that's the place that we have to begin way, way, way before we're talking about Facebook. The other thing is that I think that it's a different culture that's been created where privacy is not really at stake at all, because this whole notion of social networking is about sharing. It really is wanting everybody to know what's on your Netflix queue. And I think it is generational. I have no interest in anybody knowing that. I would say most of the people in this room don't have any sense of wanting that kind of information to be out there. So it's really critically important, as you were saying, that or maybe that you're not saying, but I don't think it's about fighting this. I think it's about really understanding it and figuring out how to work within it, kind of like within the belly of the beast. So...
I think you have to do both. I mean, what many people might not know is that as part of these techniques, the marketers devise a market plan for you as an individual and will follow you around from website to website to get you, in their own words, to convert. The idea that they have accessed your information and are purposely and stealthily engaged in getting you to do something. I mean, today it's about buying maybe a trip. But tomorrow it's about a value, a religion, a political candidate. So on the one hand, we need disclosure. On the other hand, we have to figure out, if this is the world, what do we do with it?
Do you have time for one more question?
One more question.
Okay, one more.
Hi, my name is David Freudberg. I'm from the Humankind Public Radio Program. Do you have any recommendations for public policy in this area?
Yes, I do. And some of you know that I've spent my life, both as an activist and then as a professional, working on public policy. And you know, the E-rate that put schools and computers in schools and libraries is something we worked on. The direct broadcast set-aside for educational channels is something I helped do. The Children's Online Privacy Act and others. I think now there is a need for beginning to educate policymakers at the federal level and at the state level and the local level about these changes going on in the media environment, and to identify where the opportunities are for public media and public interest media within these changes, and to begin to urge law policymakers to pass legislation that would in fact create some kind of granting system to support a variety of different efforts. You know, getting it will also try to get privacy legislation through, but it's a very, very uphill battle for that. I mean, if you go back to Microsoft, ask them what they think about privacy policy and online. You know, two years ago, last year, Microsoft changed its business model. Its future business model is interactive advertising, and they've created the Ad Lab in Beijing, where they brought in 50 PhDs to create the next generation of interactive advertising. The stakes are huge here.
Okay, I think that's going to be the last word on a topic that I think is going to be percolating throughout at least this conference, if not longer. So just a quick thank you to Jeff Chester.
Thank you very much, Jeff. Thank you very much, Lynn.
Thank you to all of you. You know, please, you know, feel free to, again, join us in the Media Policy Working Group, and we'll continue this conversation.
Great.
And there's handouts back there.
There are handouts back there, and if you make sure that you sign our sign-up sheet and the links and the reports that Jeff cited, we will be emailing them to you. So there are sign-up sheets for those of you who came in a little later. Make sure that you fill it out and give us your email address.